Well, actually, one of the things I did want to talk about, make sure that we wanted to discuss, was Nat Weiss and his comments regarding John George and Ringo's selection of Alan Klein, because Weiss has a very strong statement where he argues that John George and Ringo's selection of Klein was a betrayal and a rejection of Brian Epstein's memory. Because Klein was, in many ways, the opposite of Brian Epstein in his approach, in the way he did business, the way he regarded business deals as almost punitive, not just winning the business deal, but almost punishing the other side. The way he was boastful, the way he primarily focused, according to Weiss, on ego. He said Klein's most important aspect to him, even more so than money, was ego.
At that point, they were pretty critical of Brian, or they got pretty critical after he died. We lost a lot of money. You know, they're, when they started kind of seeing their business kind of go into the red, they seemed to sort of focus on Brian's shortcomings or perceived shortcomings as a manager. And is that sort of feeding into Klein or Nat Weiss's feeling or belief that this was a betrayal? Their selection of Klein was a betrayal of Brian.
Absolutely, it is. And Weiss directly references a comment George had evidently made that he wishes Klein had been their manager from the very
Right,
beginning.
from the very
And
beginning, yeah.
Weiss's rejoinder was not to George's face, I believe, but in the interview he did with McCabe, basically, if Klein had been your manager from the very beginning, you'd still be in Liverpool. So, yes, Weiss is obviously very irritated, if not angered, by the negative comments from Alan Klein regarding Brian, from the negative comments coming from John and George regarding Brian. And his argument is that, yes, Paul McCartney is difficult to manage. He is very difficult to manage. But you know who managed to do it? Brian Epstein. And you know who managed to split the Beatles apart in a relatively brief amount of time? Alan Klein. He also argues that Klein is not the amazing numbers man that George in particular is arguing at this time that Klein is. Weiss was a New York divorce attorney, and he makes the comment in there that any competent accountant could have done the deals that Klein did, with the possible and very significant exception of the capital deal, the royalties deal. But you have a significant amount of harsh criticism coming from Nat Weiss regarding Alan Klein. And he's not certainly planted firmly in the McCartney camp, because you have negative comments from Weiss regarding Paul's solo work. He says he's disappointed by Paul's solo work, but he also notes, but at least Paul's not criticizing Brian. And you also have Nat Weiss offering a comment that Linda, again, abandoned or ditched her New York friends. And that's part of the reason that they're getting so much negative press while this is going on. But it's an interesting element of the book that I do appreciate, because you do have someone who was close to Brian. And so you really have this coming from three different angles in Apple to the Core. You have John Eastman making his case, you have Alan Klein making his case, and then you have Nat Weiss making Brian Epstein's
This
case.
case.
And one of the interpretations that McCabe and Schonfeld appear to draw is that Brian's death was a significant structural blow to the Beatles edifice, because Brian protected them from an obsession with money. Brian protected them from spongers and hustlers, and however you want to put it, in a way that protection evaporated following his death.
Aaron, do we know right after Brian died, they went into Magical Mystery Tour. At that point, were they absolutely rudderless, or did Brian's brother Clive step in the breach?
I'm trying to remember how much detail McCabe and Schoenfeld go into with that. You do have mentions of Clive, and you have mentions of various other managerial options. But again, to go back to those comments made by Weiss regarding the selection of Klein being a client, you have comments from Ringo in November 1971, the David Vedder interview with Playboy, where Ringo says something to the effect, I can't remember whether the term he uses is gangster or shark, but Ringo says the music industry is full of gangsters. Let's say that's what the word he used. And I want a gangster working for me. We do have evidence that, oh, and in that same interview, you have Yoko making a comment that she thinks Klein is too nice in regards to some of his business dealings. It's really interesting because the implication that you get from Weiss, and again with Ringo's comment, is that John, George, and Ringo did not want a manager in the mold of Brian Epstein following Brian's death. And of course, we have no idea, no way of knowing what would have happened had Brian not died. But Clive would have been a pale imitation of Brian. Peter Brown would have been a pale imitation of Brian. It seems very clear that the other three did not want that. Even John Eastman, in a lot of ways, could be seen as an imitation of Brian. He's an urbane Jewish gentleman, handsome, polished, better educated than Brian, but also someone who has experience in music publishing. So he's not a novice to this. So it's just an interesting element that I feel could merit some more exploration from Beatles authors in Beatles historiography, this compulsion that evidently some of the three Beatles felt regarding not just we need a manager following the financial debacle that was occurring at Apple, but we want a manager that approaches things differently and engages differently than Brian did. So one of the other areas that I particularly wanted to discuss was the trial. And this aspect of Apple to the Core is one of the areas where I do believe its influence has been considerable, because the reality is that it is very difficult to get a hold of actual documentation from the trial. And you simply can't access it for a variety of reasons, primarily legal ones. So you have to rely, for a variety of authors, as well as for a variety of fans, on what is available. And one of the greatest strengths of Apple to the Core is that about the last 10 to 15 pages, you have McCabe and Schoenfeld giving a rough, not blow-by-blow description of the trial, but what they do have is they lay out, these are the major arguments being made by Paul McCartney's legal team, and these are the counter-arguments being laid out by Apple, Klein, John George, and Ringo, and this is how the trial unfolds. There are some areas that they do not discuss and address, but you do get excellent quotations, as I mentioned, lengthy quotations in certain parts from Justice Stamp's written decision. And again, this is the part of the book that certainly seems to indicate that this was not a very close decision. And reading this, there are a few elements that really interested me. And again, I want to preface this with, I do not have a background in law or a background in finance, but my reading of most books in Beatles historiography has been that Klein's appointment as Apple's manager was legal under British partnership law. And that completely ignores the element of the unofficial unanimity clause that the Beatles had. If we simply ignore that, because I'm not sure regarding the legality of that particular argument, although we do have evidence that that clause did exist and was frankly ignored in the appointment of Klein as head of Apple. But what Stamp appears to say is that the 1967 contract that Paul is suing to dissolve doesn't necessarily allow for the appointment of Klein as manager, because the 1967 contract says that agents can be appointed, but Stamp argues that a manager is significantly greater and has much more influence than an agent does. So it appears that Stamp is arguing that Apple even had the authority to appoint Klein as manager. Here's the quote that I have from Apple to the Core. John, George, and Ringo claimed that the appointment of Klein was justified because of the 1967 contract's ability to appoint agents. But Justice Stamp determined, quote, a manager is no doubt an agent, but he is much more than that. The appointment of ABCO without the concurrence of the plaintiff was, in my judgment, a breach of the terms of the partnership deed, end quote.
Yeah.
In addition to that, so we have basically the conclusion by Stamp that Klein should not have been appointed manager 3-1 under the 1967 contract. You also have the argument regarding Klein's excessive commissions. The area here, and again, I'm treading carefully because this is absolutely not my area of expertise. So the issue we have is that you have Klein submitting the financial documentation regarding Apple. And in that documentation, the Eastmans discover that Klein has taken his commission off of the gross profit rather than off of the excess profit, which is what is stipulated in his managerial contract. And so Stamp's response to this is to say, what do the Beatles think of this? What do John, George, Ringo, and Paul regard? How do they regard Klein taking this commission off the gross instead of off of the profit, as his contract says? Well, you have no negative response from John, George, and Ringo. And what McCabe does is he quotes some of John's testimony where John claims that so far as John knows, Klein has not taken any commission to which he is not legally entitled. And so this is where Stamp argues that Klein is deceiving someone, one of the Beatles, or he's deceiving all of the Beatles. Because how this has to work, because you have these claims from John, George, and Ringo that so far as they know, Klein is not taking excessive commissions, even though the documentation proves that he is, then either Klein is taking these excessive commissions without the permission of John, George, and Ringo, in which case he is deceiving John, George, Ringo, and Paul, or Stamp appears to argue that the more logical conclusion is that John, George, and Ringo entered into an oral contract with Klein, which in which they told Klein, we'll let you have the 20% commission on the gross and not on the profit, but they did so without signing an actual document and without notifying Paul that this change was going to take place, in which case Klein is deceiving Paul, as are John, George, and Ringo.
Yeah. Can I just read it? You have a quote here in your notes that's sort of related to that. Stan reduces Klein's previous claim of not benefiting, contrasting with his taking excessive commissions to which he was not contractually entitled, to quote, the irresponsible patter of a second-rate salesman. So it sounds like Stamp wasn't buying it one way or the other.
Well, and it's very interesting because Klein's argument when the excessive commission issue is discovered in the documentation, his justification to Stamp is, well, I took that commission after paying for some overhead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he doesn't deny that he took commission to which he was not contractually entitled, or that he took commission of which one of the four partners was completely ignorant that the contract had been orally altered. And I'm not even sure, it doesn't delve into the issue of whether that's even legal.
Legal, yeah.
Whether the other three partners can discuss with one another, we're going to change the commissions of our manager, and we're not even going to alert our fourth partner that we're going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the book that you have, which tends to argue a more client-friendly version of the trial, is Fred Goodman's biography of Alan Klein. And Goodman's argument, and this is a book I've read or haven't read in several years, so I would have to double check on this, but my memory is telling me that Goodman's justification for why Paul is not informed of this change in contract, assuming, of course, that John, George, and Ringo approved this, is because Paul was difficult to get a hold of in this time period.
But, you know, isn't that bull? If this is a legal, this is something that you, so I couldn't reach you, so I'm going to do it anyway, is the argument. You know, it's just so nonsensical.
Well, and that's the issue for me. Is it legal?
Yeah.
I honestly, again, I don't know. I don't know whether John, George, and Ringo had the legal ability to orally change Klein's managerial commissions without informing Paul. But this whole
court case, though, wasn't to assign culpability. It was just to really determine whether they needed to have their business go into receivership. Someone needed to oversee it. And Stamp clearly thought there was enough proof to say, I think I have a quote from you from via the book, that however successful Mr. Klein may have been in generating income, I am satisfied on the evidence of the accountants and accounts to which I am referred. The financial situation is confused, uncertain, and confusing. A receiver is, in my judgment, needed not merely to secure the assets, but so that there may be a firm hand to manage the business fairly as between the partners and to produce order. I have no doubt that a receiver and a manager ought to be appointed.
Well, and that's one of the issues, is one of the arguments that Paul makes is that Klein has been in charge of the Beatles' finances for 16 months, and only one production or only one accounting has been done in 16 months. And again, Klein argues, well, our accountant quit and it took us 6 months to find another accountant. There are so many issues. I mean, first of all, that was Klein's background. He was an accountant.
Mm-hmm.
But there are so many areas where it appears that Klein was mismanaging, in that the argument that McCabe makes is that Paul was interested in exploring the financial and tax repercussions of a split as early as June 1970. And McCabe dates that to a document that John Eastman sends Alan Klein in June 1970, where Eastman subtly insults Klein, says something, you need to put your fertile mind, end quote, to investigating the financial and tax repercussions of a split in the partnership. And according to McCabe, Klein does not do that. So John Eastman is sending Alan Klein a warning that we are looking into this. That's what John Eastman says. We are looking into the financial repercussions of this. You need to do so too. Klein does not do that. McCabe seems to imply that Klein chose not to do that simply because he did not want to put his fertile mind to work for John Eastman, which, if true, is massively petty and also massively incorrect, in that he is not preparing for what John Eastman is very clearly indicating to him.
Yeah.
And then you have McCabe following through the timeline where he argues that in August of 1970, you have Paul sending that letter to John, that personal letter about How do we get out of this partnership? How do we break out?
And you also have in the new musical Express letter back to Paul, where John is opining and lamenting about all the tax issues. So they certainly became aware of it in 71.
That's in 1971, though.
Yeah.
But yes, but yes, you bring up a very valid point, because here we have the primary argument that is coming from Klein, that is also coming from John Lennon and George Harrison. The Beatles cannot split up because of the tax hit they are going to take if the partnership dissolves. But McCabe implicates or indicates that Klein did not investigate that. Mm-hmm. Or he certainly didn't do it prior to the trial. And so what numbers is Klein coming up with? Because the implication we get from McCabe is that Klein did not do his research prior to the actual trial.
Yeah. And it's almost like he didn't think that Paul would win the case, that the Beatles would indeed break up.
Well, that's exactly the implication, again, that we get from John Eastman after the trial is over. And he's saying, Klein evidently thought I was stupid and that Paul was a chicken shit. We would not actually go to trial. Now, you have Klein, after the trial is done, saying, oh, we never really had a chance, but I had to fight because of the tax issues. But he never actually gives out any numbers for what mm-hmm. sort of tax the Beatles are going to take or the partnership is going to take once it dissolves. And again, the implication for McCabe is that he did not research that.
Yeah.
So, and in addition to that, McCabe states that the reason Paul filed is that the final financial straw was that the Beatles didn't file their taxes in 1970. And they were late filing their taxes, that Klein didn't get the Beatles' taxes filed by November of 1970. And that was why Paul finally launched the lawsuit when he did. And if so, that is a massive mistake on behalf of Alan Klein, because he has already been in trouble with his failure to file taxes in mm-hmm. the United States. So, I mean, certainly the implication that you get from Stamp is that this trial is not particularly close, and that Klein is deceiving at best one of the Beatles mm-hmm. and at worst all of the Beatles.
Yeah.
That their financial situation is in chaos. Klein has had 16 months to get some order out of it and has failed to do so. Mm-hmm. You have Stamp arguing that Klein's very appointment was not legitimate under the Apple contract that all four Beatles had signed in 1967. And despite all this, you have McCabe interviewing Klein and John after the trial is over. And when McCabe asks Klein why they lost, Klein's response is the establishment.
Yeah. Yeah.
The establishment does not like him. And mm-hmm. that is why they lost mm-hmm. the trial. That's also mm-hmm. why Klein claims that he dropped his appeal, because the quote is, the establishment. I am not too well liked in England. Whereas John's response to all of the accusations made against Klein and to Stamp's decision is that Klein lost the trial because Klein is abrasive and he's an American.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
So you have no discussion of the actual legal arguments against mm-hmm. Klein.
Yeah.
And instead, you have, and this is in 1971, 72, John not dealing with the actual issue, but again, seeing Klein as a victim of the establishment, and that's why Justice Stamp ruled repeatedly mm-hmm. against Alan Klein, because he didn't like him, because, quote, he was an American and brash, end quote.
And on an interesting, ironic note, in 73, John changes his mind because they are now suing Alan Klein.
Well, and that's a good quote to sort of start and wrap this up, because, again, you have that issue of the chronology of this book being so important, because you have a quote at the very end of Apple to the Core where McCabe says, Klein's three beetles seem very satisfied with him. End quote. Page 197. And of course, within a year, they will drop him as their manager, and then they will sue him for $19 million.
Yeah. Yeah. As well, the Stones and et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
It's too bad McCabe didn't wait 6 months before he published the book or did a little bit of research more into Alan Klein's business dealings. He might have had a different ending.
Well, I think it's just a great demonstration of the importance of historical distance. Now, I do think there's a lot of value in Klein writing when he did, because that's where...
Oh, you mean McCabe?
Oh, yes. Sorry. Yeah. That's where you get a lot of, again, primary source material regarding the trial. But at the same time, because of the political climate he's writing in, because of the agenda-driven year in which he's getting his evidence, because of the type of evidence he primarily relies on, which are interviews, which are not verified, he gets stuck in an unenviable position of drawing these conclusions that very quickly turn on their head.
Yeah. And to come full circle to how we started, you were saying that other biographies have referenced this book, sort of taking it out of whole cloth. And, you know, it's one thing, I guess, to reference, well, they could reference Judge Stamp's decision, because that would be an independent, that could be independently corroborated. But to reference Apple to the Core and some of the erroneous assumptions that are made by McCabe is just perpetuating the same error over and over again.
Right. And that's why this is a book that absolutely has to be analyzed, again, particularly in the period of its chronology. The evidence that the author had, the evidence that the author did not, the political climate at the time, the conclusions that the author draws, in some cases, flawed conclusions that are very quickly going to change. So this is a book that I would certainly argue is extremely influential, extremely important, has been referenced numerous times by many significant and well-read Beatles books, but it is absolutely a book that has to be evaluated in the context of its time period, and it is not a book without flaws. Again, there are omissions, there are judgments, there are facts that are not represented or that are misrepresented, and this is something that, like many other Beatles books, is extremely influential, but absolutely has to be closely analyzed.
So the recommendation for folks wanting to review this book, what would that recommendation be?
I would absolutely recommend people to read this book. And particularly if you are interested in the trial, and also just to get a good evaluation of how the Beatles breakup is being written in 1971, 1972. It gives you an excellent snapshot of how it's being portrayed in this time period, the reasons that are being given for how it occurred and who is to blame, and many of our evaluations and interpretations on those issues have shifted, certainly over the decades. But Apple to the Core is extremely influential. It's got excellent primary source material that you really can't get anywhere else. And it has very good insight into this is what people were saying and this is who people were blaming in 1971 and 1972.
We hope you enjoyed our review of Apple to the Core by Peter McCabe and Robert Schoenfeld. We hope you join us next time when Aaron and I review Hunter Davies, The Beatles, the Authorized Biography.